But still, it's a toy. Why this slice of the past? What's next? The Japanese POW internment camp playset? The Trail of Tears Lego? The Salem Witch Hunt game? I wanted to tell you before you read it in the paper, Christina says. Larry's thinking of running for Congress. Wow, I answer. How do you feel about that? She throws her arms around me. Thank you. Do you realize you're the first friend I've told who doesn't act like this is the first step to the White House or start talking about whether we should get a place in Bethesda or Arlington? You're the first person, period, who it occurred to that I might have a choice in the matter. Well, don't you? It seems like a pretty big disruption for the whole family. Yeah, Christina says. I'm not sure I have the fortitude to be the wife of a politician. I laugh. You have the fortitude to run the country by yourself. That's exactly what I mean. Apparently, I'm supposed to forget the fact that I graduated summa cum laude, and instead I get to stand around holding my cute kid and smiling like the only thought I can hold in my head is what shade of lipstick matches my blouse. Christina sighs. Promise me something. If I ever cut my hair into a bob that kind of looks like a helmet, you'll euthanize me? You see, I tell myself, here's proof. I've known Christina my whole life. And yes, maybe there are differences between us, socioeconomic, political, racial, but that doesn't mean we can't connect, human to human, friend to friend. Sounds to me like you've already made up your mind, I point out. She looks at me hopeless. I can't say no to him, Christina sighs. That's why I fell for him in the first place. I know, I tell her, but it could be worse. How? Congressmen serve for 2 years, I point out. 2 years is a blink. Imagine if he set his heart on being a senator. She shudders, then grins. If he makes it to the White House, Christina says, I'm hiring you as my chief of staff. Maybe Surgeon General, I counter. Christina links her arm through mine as we walk back to the gold room, where my mama is now setting out a tray of china and a teapot, a platter of homemade almond cookies. Felix sits on the floor, playing with a wooden train. Lou, I dream about these cookies, Christina says. She hugs my mama before reaching for one. We are so lucky to have you as part of our family. Family doesn't get a paycheck, I think. I smile. But like anything you wear that doesn't fit, it pinches. During one of those indentured servant Saturdays when I was playing hide-and-seek with Christina and Rachel, I took a wrong turn and found myself in a room that was off-limits. Mr. Hallowell's study was usually locked, but when I turned the knob, desperate to hide from the high-pitched squeal of Christina calling, "Ready or not, here I come!" I found myself stumbling inside the secret sanctum. Rachel and I had spent a good deal of time imagining what might be behind that closed door. She thought it was a laboratory with rows and rows of pickled body parts. I thought it was candy, because in my 7-year-old mind, that was the most valuable stash worth locking up. But when I landed on my hands and knees on the oriental rug in Mr. Hallowell's study, the reality was pretty disappointing. There was a leather couch, shelves and shelves of what looked like silver wheels, a portable movie screen, and feeding the film into the chattering teeth of a projector was Sam Hallowell himself. I always thought Mr. Hallowell looked like a movie star, and Mama used to say he practically was one. As he turned around, pinning me with his gaze, I tried to come up with an excuse for why I had breached this forbidden territory, but was distracted by the grainy picture on the screen of Tinkerbell lighting animated fireworks over a castle. "This is all you've ever known," he said, and I realized that his speech was funny, that the words blurred into each other. He lifted a glass to his mouth, and I heard the ice cubes clink. "You have no idea what it was like to see the world change in front of your eyes." On the screen, a man I didn't recognize was speaking. "Color does brighten things up, doesn't it?" he said, as a black and white wall of photos behind him bloomed into all the shades of a rainbow. "Walt Disney was a genius," Mr. Hallowell mused. He sat down on the couch and patted the seat beside him, and I scrambled over. A cartoon duck with glasses and a thick accent was sticking his hand in animated cans of paint and dumping the contents on the floor. "You mix them all together and they spell muddy, and then you got black," the cartoon duck said, stirring the paint with his flippered foot so that it turned ebony. "That's exactly the way things were at the very beginning of time. Black. Man was completely in the dark about color. Why? Because he was stupid." Mr. Hollowell was close enough now for me to smell his breath. Sour, like that of my Uncle Isaiah, who'd missed Christmas last year because Mama said he had gone somewhere to dry out. "Christina and Louis and you and your sister, you don't know any different. For you, it's always looked like this." He stood up suddenly and turned to me so that the projector shadowed his face. A dance of bright silhouettes. "The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC, he boomed, spreading his arms so wide that the liquid in his glass sloshed over the side and onto the carpet. "What do you think, Ruth?" he asked. I thought that I wanted him to move so I could see what the duck was going to do next. Mr. Hollowell's voice softened. "I used to say that before every program," he told me. "Until color TV was so common, no one needed reminding that it was a miracle. But before that, I was the voice of the future. Me, Sam Hollowell. The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC. I didn't tell him to move over so that I could see the cartoon. I sat with my hands in my lap, because I knew that sometimes when people spoke, it wasn't because they had something important to say. It's because they had a powerful need for someone to listen. Late that night, after my mama had brought us back home and tucked us into our beds, I had a nightmare. I opened my eyes and everything was cast in shades of gray, like the man on the movie screen before he pinked up and the background exploded with color. I saw myself running through the brownstone, pulling at locked doors until Mr. Hollowell's study opened. The film we had watched was ticking through the projector, but the picture was black and white now, too. I started screaming, and my mama rushed in, and Rachel and Ms. Mina, and Christina, and even Mr. Hollowell. But when I told them my eyes weren't working, and that all the color in the world had vanished, they laughed at me. "Ruth," they said, "this is the way it always has been. Always will be." By the time my train gets back to New Haven, Edison is already home and bent over the kitchen table doing his schoolwork. "Hey, baby," I say, dropping a kiss on the crown of his head as I walk in and giving him an extra squeeze. "That's from Grandma Lou. Aren't you supposed to be at work? I had a half an hour before my shift starts, and I decided I'd rather spend it with you than in traffic." His eyes flicker toward me. "You're gonna be late." "You're worth it," I tell him. I grab an apple from a bowl in the middle of the kitchen table. I always keep something healthy there because Edison will eat whatever's not nailed down and take a bite, reaching for some of the papers spread out in front of my son. "Henry O. Flipper," I read. "Sounds like a leprechaun. He was the first African-American graduate from West Point. Everyone in AP history has to teach a class profiling an American hero, and I'm trying to figure out what my lesson's going to be." "Who else is in the running?" Edison looks up. "Bill Pickett, a black cowboy and rodeo star. And Christian Fleetwood, a black Civil War soldier who won the Medal of Honor." I glance at the grainy photos of each man. "I don't know any of these people." "Yeah, that's the point," Edison says. "We get Rosa Parks and Dr. King, and that's about it. You ever hear of a brother named Louis Latimer? He drew telephone parts for Alexander Graham Bell's patent applications and worked as a draftsman and patent expert for Thomas Edison. But you didn't name me after him because you didn't know he existed. The only time people who look like us are making history, it's a footnote." He says this without bitterness, the way he would announce that we are out of ketchup or that his socks turned pink in the wash. As if it's something he's not thrilled about, but can't get worked up over, because it's unlikely to change the outcome at this particular moment. I find myself thinking about Mrs. Bronstein and Virginia again. It feels like a splinter my mind keeps getting caught on, and Edison just pressed deep on it again. Have I really never noticed these things before? Or have I been very studiously keeping my eyes shut? Edison glances at his watch. Mama, he says, you're going to be really late. He's right. I tell him what he can heat up for dinner, what time he should go to bed, what time my shift's over. And then I hurry to my car and drive to the hospital. I take as many shortcuts as I can, but I'm still 10 minutes late. I take the stairs instead of waiting for the elevator, and by the time I reach the birthing pavilion, I'm out of breath and sweating. Marie is standing at the nurse's desk, as if she's waiting on me. I'm sorry, I say immediately. I was in New York with my mother, then stuck in traffic, and, Ruth, I can't let you work tonight. I am dumbfounded. Corinne is late more than 50% of the time, but I have a single transgression and I get punished for it? It won't happen again, I say. I can't let you work, Marie repeats. And I realize that she hasn't met my gaze. Not once. I have been informed by HR that your license is being suspended. Suddenly I am made of stone. What? I'm so sorry, she whispers. Security will escort you out of the building after you clear out your locker. Wait, I say, noticing the two goons who are hovering behind the nurse's desk. You're kidding me. Why is my license being suspended? And how am I supposed to work if it is? Marie draws in her breath and turns to the security guards. They step forward. Ma'am, one of them says, and he gestures toward the break room, as if after 20 years, I might not know the way. The little cardboard box I carry out to the car has a toothbrush, toothpaste, a bottle of Advil, a cardigan sweater, and a collection of photos of Edison. That's all I kept in my locker at work. It sits in the back seat and keeps drawing my attention in the rearview mirror, surprising me like a passenger I wasn't expecting. I have not even pulled out of the parking lot before I call the union lawyer. It's 5 p.m., and the chances of him being at his desk are slim, so when he answers the phone, I burst into tears. I tell him about Turk Bauer and the baby, and he calms me down and says he will do some digging and call me back. I should go home. I should make sure Edison is all right. But that will spark a conversation about why I'm not at work, and I'm not sure I can cope with that right now. If the union lawyer does his job, maybe I can even be reinstated before I'm supposed to work tomorrow night. Then my phone rings. Ruth, Corinne says, what the fuck is going on? I lean back against the driver's seat, closing my eyes. I don't know, I admit. Hang on, she says, and I hear muffled noises. I'm in the goddamn supply closet for privacy. I called you as soon as I heard. Heard what? I don't know anything except that my license is apparently being suspended. Well, that bitchy hospital lawyer said something to Marie about professional misconduct. Carla Luongo? Who's she? The bitchy hospital lawyer. She threw me under the bus, I say, bitter. Carla and I had each gotten a glimpse of the other's cards, and I thought that was enough for us to implicitly agree we both had aces. I just never expected her to play her hand so quickly. That racist father must have threatened a lawsuit, and she sacrificed me to save the hospital. There's a pause. It's so small that maybe if I wasn't listening for it, I might not have heard it. And then Corinne, my colleague, my friend, says, I'm sure it wasn't intentional. At Dalton, there was one table at lunch where all the black kids sat, except me. Once, another scholarship student of color invited me to join them for lunch. I said thanks, but I usually spent that time tutoring a white friend who didn't understand trig. This was not the truth. The truth was that the black table made my white friends nervous, because even if they'd sat down there with me, they would have been tolerated but not welcomed. In a world where they always fit in, the one place they didn't, chafed hard. The other truth was that if I sat with the kids of color, I couldn't pretend I was different from them. When Mr. Adamson, my history teacher, started talking about Martin Luther King and kept looking at me, my white friend shrugged it off. He didn't mean it in that way. At the black table, if one student talked about Mr. Adamson staring at her during the same lesson, Another African-American student would validate the experience. That totally happened to me, too. I wanted so badly to blend in high school that I surrounded myself with people who could convince me that if I felt like I was being singled out because of the color of my skin, I was making things up, overthinking, being ridiculous. There was no black table in the cafeteria at the hospital. There were a handful of janitors of color, and one or two doctors, and me. I want to ask Corinne when she was last black, because then, and only then, would she have the right to tell me if Carla Luongo's actions were intentional or accidental. But instead, I tell her I have to go, and I hang up while she is still responding. Then I drive out of the hospital where I've been hiding for 2 decades, underneath a highway that pulses with New York-bound traffic like an artery. I pass a small tent city of homeless vets and a drug deal going down, and park outside the projects where my sister lives. She answers the door with a toddler on her hip and a wooden spoon in her hand, and an expression on her face that suggests she has been expecting me for years. "Why are you surprised?" Adisa asks. "What did you think was going to happen, moving into Whiteville?" "East End," I correct, and she just gives me a look. We are sitting at her kitchen table. Given the sheer number of children she lives with, the apartment is remarkably clean. Pages from coloring books are taped to the wall, and there is a macaroni casserole in the oven. In the kitchen, Adisa's oldest, Tayana, is feeding the baby at her high chair. Two of the boys are playing Nintendo in the living room. Her other child is MIA. "I hate to say I told you so." "No, you don't," I mutter. "You've been waiting to tell me that forever." She shrugs, agreeing. "You're the one who kept saying, 'Adisa, you don't know what you're talking about. My skin color isn't even a factor.' And go figure, you're not just like one of them, are you? You know, if I wanted to be a punching bag, I could have just stayed at the hospital." I bury my face in my hands. "What am I supposed to tell Edison?" "The truth," Adisa suggests. "There's no shame in it. It's not like you did anything wrong. It's better he learn earlier than his mama that he can run with the white crowd, but it don't make him any less black." When Edison was younger, Adisa used to babysit him after school if I pulled an afternoon shift until he begged to stay home alone. His cousins ribbed him for not being able to understand their slang, and when he did start to master it, his white friends in school looked at him like he had grown a second head. Even I was having trouble understanding my nephews, elbowing each other on the couch and laughing until Tayana whacked them both with a dish towel so that she could put the baby to sleep. "Oh, we out here," I heard one of the boys say, and it took me a few minutes to realize that translated to, "We're out here," and that Tabari was teasing his brother for thinking he was all that because he won a round of the game. Edison might not have fit in with the white kids in his school, but that at least he could blame on his skin. He didn't fit in with his cousins either. And they looked like him. Adisa folds her arms. "You need to find a lawyer and sue that damn hospital right back." "That costs money," I groan. "I just want this all to go away." My heart starts to hammer. I can't lose our home. I can't take my savings, all of which is Edison's college fund, and liquidate it just so we can eat and pay the mortgage and buy gas. I can't ruin my son's opportunities just because mine blew up in my face. Adisa must see that I'm on the verge of a total breakdown because she reaches for my hand. "Ruth," she says softly, "your friends may have turned on you, but you know what the good thing is about having a sister? It's forever." She locks her eyes on mine. Her eyes are so dark that you can barely see the edge between iris and pupil, but they're steady. And she doesn't let go of me. And slowly, slowly, I let myself breathe. When I return to my house at 7 o'clock, Edison comes running to the front door. "What are you doing home?" he asks. "Is everything okay?" I paste a smile on my face. "I'm fine, baby. There was just a mix-up with the shifts, so Corinne and I went out to dinner at Olive Garden. Are there leftovers?" God bless the teenage boy who can't see past his own hunger pangs. "No," I tell him. "We shared an entree." Well, that seems like a missed opportunity, he grumbles. Did you wind up writing about Latimer? He shakes his head. No, I think I'm going to pick Anthony Johnson. First black landowner, he says, way back in 1651. Wow, I reply. That's impressive. Yeah, but there's kind of a hitch. See, he was a slave that came over to Virginia from England and worked on a tobacco plantation until it was attacked by Native Americans, and everyone but five people there died. He and his wife Mary moved and claimed 250 acres of land. The thing is, he owned slaves. And I don't know if I feel like being the one to tell that to the rest of my class, you know? Like it's something they can use against me someday in an argument. He shakes his head, lost in thought. I mean, how could you do that if you knew what it was like to be a slave yourself once? I think about all the things I've done to feel like I belong at the top. Education, marriage, this home, keeping a barrier between myself and my sister. I don't know, I say slowly. In his world, the people with power owned other people. Maybe that's what he thought he needed to do to feel powerful, too. That doesn't mean it was right, Edison points out. I wrap my arms around his waist and hold him tight, pressing my face against his shoulder so he cannot see the tears in my eyes. What's that for? Because, I murmur, you make this world a better place. Edison hugs me back. Imagine what I could do if you'd brought me a chicken parm. Once he goes to bed, I sift through the mail. Bills, bills, and more bills. Plus one slim envelope from the Department of Public Health, revoking my nursing license. I stare at it for 5 whole minutes, but the words don't materialize into anything other than what it is. The proof that this is not a nightmare I will wake up from, wondering at my own crazy imagination. Instead, I sit in the living room, my thoughts racing too fast for me to think about turning in. It's a mistake, that's all. I know it. I just need to make everyone else see it, too. I'm a nurse. I heal people. I bring them comfort. I fix things. I can fix this. My phone buzzes in my pocket. I glance at the number. It's the union lawyer calling me back. Ruth, he says when I answer. I hope it's not too late. I almost laugh, as if I'm going to get any sleep tonight. Why did the Department of Public Health take away my license? Because of an allegation of possible negligence, he explains. But I didn't do anything wrong. I've worked there for 20 years. Can they still fire me? You've got bigger problems than keeping your job. A criminal prosecution has been filed against you, Ruth. The state is holding you responsible for the death of that baby. I don't understand, I say, the sentence sharp as knives on my tongue. They've already convened a grand jury. My advice is for you to hire a defense attorney. This is out of my league. This is not real. This can't be real. My supervisor said not to touch the infant, and I didn't, and now I'm being punished for it? The state doesn't care what your supervisor said, the union lawyer replies. The state just sees a dead baby. They're targeting you because they think you failed as a nurse. You're wrong. I shake my head in the darkness, and I say the words I've swallowed down my whole life. They're targeting me because I'm black. In spite of all this, I fall asleep. I know this because when I first hear the jackhammer at 3 a.m., I think it's part of my dream. Me, stuck in traffic, late for work, while a road crew creates a canyon between me and where I need to be. In my dream, I honk the car horn. The jackhammer doesn't stop. And then, just like that, I am bursting through the surface of consciousness, and the jackhammer of knocking detonates as the police break the door off its hinges and swarm into my living room, their guns drawn. What are you doing? I cry out. What are you doing? Ruth Jefferson, one of them yells, and I can't find my voice. I can't speak at all. So I just jerk my chin. Yes. Immediately, he pulls my arm behind my back and pushes me face down onto the floor, his knee in the small of my back as he zips a plastic tie around my wrists. The others are overturning furniture, dumping drawers onto the floor, sweeping books off the shelves. A grand jury has charged you with murder and involuntary manslaughter, the policeman says. You're under arrest. Another voice pierces through the tinny echo of these words. Mama? Edison asks. What's going on? All eyes turn to the doorway of the bedroom. Don't move, shouts another cop, aiming his gun at my baby. Hands in the air! I start to scream. They are all over Edison, three of them wrestling him onto the ground. He is handcuffed like me. I see him straining toward me, panic lining every muscle of his neck, the whites of his eyes rolling as he tries to see if I'm all right. Leave him be, I sob. He has nothing to do with this. But they don't know that. All they see is a 6-foot-tall black boy. Do what they say, Edison, I cry. And call your aunt! My joints crack as the policeman who was holding me down suddenly yanks me upright by my wrists, pulling my body in a way it doesn't want to go. The other policemen file behind, leaving the contents of my kitchen cabinets, my bookshelves, my drawers in heaps on the floor. I am wide awake now, being dragged in my nightgown and slippers down my porch steps so that I stumble and scrape my knee on the pavement before I am pushed headfirst into the back of a police car. I pray to God that someone will remember to cut my son's hands loose. I pray to God that my neighbors, who have been awakened by the hullabaloo in our sleepy neighborhood at 3 a.m., and who stand in their doorways with their white faces reflecting the moon, will ask themselves one day why they remained dead silent, not a single one asking if there was anything they could do to help. I have been to the police station before. I went when my car was sideswiped in a grocery store parking lot, and the fool who did it just drove off. I held the hand of a patient who had been sexually assaulted and couldn't get the courage to tell the authorities. But now, I am brought into the station the back way, where the bright fluorescent lights make me blink. I am handed off to another officer, just a boy, really, who sits me down and asks for my name, my address, my date of birth, my social security number. I speak so softly that a few times he has to ask me to be louder. Then I am led to what looks like a copy machine, except it's not. My fingers are rolled one by one across the glass surface, and the print appears on the screen. Pretty awesome, right? The boy says. I wonder if my fingerprints are already in the system. When Edison was in kindergarten, I had gone with him to a community safety day to get him fingerprinted. He was scared. So I did it first. Back then, I believed that the worst thing that could ever happen was that he might be taken from me. It never occurred to me that I might be taken from him. I am then placed up against a cinder block wall and photographed straight on and in profile. The young cop leads me to the only cell that our police department has, which is small and dark and freezing cold. There is a toilet in the corner. And a long-necked sink. Excuse me, I say, clearing my throat as the door locks behind me. How long do I stay here? He looks at me, not without sympathy. As long as it takes, he says, cryptically. And then he is gone. I sit down on the bench. It is made of metal, and the chill goes right through my nightgown. I have to pee, but I am too embarrassed to do it here, in the open, because what if that's the moment they come for me? I wonder if Edison has called Adisa, if even now she is trying to get me out of here. I wonder if Adisa has filled him in, told him about the baby that died. I wonder if my own boy blames me. I have a sudden flash of myself just 12 hours ago, dipping strands of a crystal chandelier into an ammonia solution while classical music played in the Hollowell's brownstone. The incongruity makes me choke on a laugh. Or perhaps it is a sob. I can't tell anymore. Maybe if Adisa can't get me out of here, the Hollowells can. They know people who know people. But my mama would have to be told what happened first. And although she would defend me to her death, I know there would be a part of her thinking, how did it come to this? How did this girl whose lucky life I broke my back for wind up in a jail cell? And I wouldn't know the answer. On one side of the seesaw is my education, my nursing certification, My 20 years of service at the hospital. My neat little home. My spotless Toyota RAV4. My National Honor Society inductee son. All these building blocks of my existence. And yet the only quality straddling the other side is so hulking and dense that it tips the balance every time. My brown skin. Well, I didn't do all this hard work for nothing. I can still use that fancy college degree and the years I've spent in the company of white people to turn this around, to make the policemen understand that this is a misunderstanding. Like them, I live in this town. Like them, I pay my taxes. They have so much more in common with me than with the angry bigot who started this debacle. I have no idea how long it is until someone returns to the cell. I don't have a watch or a clock, but it's enough time for me to get that spark of hope burning in my chest again. So when I hear the tumblers click, I look up with a grateful smile. "I'm going to take you for questioning," the young officer says. "I have to, you know..." He gestures to my hands. I stand up. "You must be exhausted," I tell him, "staying awake all night." He shrugs, but he also blushes. "Someone's got to do it. I bet your mama's so proud of you." "I know I would be. I think my son's only a couple of years younger than you." I hold my hands out in front of me, innocent and wide-eyed, as he glances down at my wrists. "You know, I think we're okay without him," he says after a beat. He puts his hand on my arm, still firmly guiding me. I hide my smile inside. I take this as a victory. I am left alone in a room with a large mirror that I am sure is a window to another space on the other side of the wall. There is a tape recorder on the table, and a fan that is whirring overhead, although it is freezing here, too. I flex my hands on my lap, waiting. I don't stare at my reflection because I know they are watching, and because of this, I can only catch a glimpse of myself. In my nightgown, I might as well be a ghost. When the door opens, two detectives enter, a bull of a man and a tiny sprite. "I'm Detective McDougal," says the man, "and this is Detective Leong." She smiles at me. I try to read into it. "You are a woman too," I think, hoping for telepathy. "You are Asian American. You've been in my seat metaphorically, if not literally." "Can I get you some water, Mrs. Jefferson?" asks Detective Leong. "That would be nice," I say. While she goes to get me water, Detective McDougal explains to me that I don't have to talk to them, but if I do, what I say might be used against me in court. Then again, he points out, if I have nothing to hide, maybe I'd like to give them my side of the story. "Yes," I say, although I have watched enough cop shows to know that I'm supposed to shut up. "But that is fiction. This is real life. I didn't do anything illegal, and if I don't explain, how will anyone ever know that? If I don't explain, doesn't that just make me look like I'm guilty?" He asks if it's all right to turn on the tape recorder. "Of course," I say, "and thank you. Thank you so much for being willing to hear me out. This is all a very big misunderstanding, I'm afraid." By now, Detective Leong is back. She hands me the water and I drink it all, a full 8-ounce glass. I did not know until I started how thirsty I was. "Be that as it may, Miss Jefferson," says McDougal, "we have some pretty strong evidence to contradict what you're saying. You don't deny that you were present when Davis Bauer died?" "No," I reply. "I was there. It was awful." "What were you doing at the time?" "I was part of the crash team. The baby became very ill, very fast. We did the best we could." "Yet I just finished looking at photos from the medical examiner that suggest the child was physically abused." "Well, there you are," I blurt out. "I didn't touch that baby." "You just said you were part of the crash team," McDougal points out. "But I didn't touch the baby until he started to code. At which point you started hammering on the baby's chest." My face flushes with heat. "What? No, I was doing CPR. A bit too enthusiastically, according to eyewitnesses, the detective adds. "Who?" I think, running through my brain to list all the people who were there with me. Who would have seen what I was doing and not recognized it for what it was? Emergency medical care. Mrs. Jefferson, Detective Leong asks, did you have any discussions with anyone in the hospital about your feelings for this baby and his family? No, I was taken off the case, and that was that. McDougal narrows his eyes. You didn't have a problem with Turk Bauer? I forced myself to take a deep breath. We didn't see eye to eye. Do you feel that way about all white people? Some of my best friends are white. I meet his gaze squarely. McDougal stares at me for so long I can see his pupils shrink. I know he is waiting to see if I'll turn away first. Instead, I notch up my chin. He pushes back from the table and stands up. I have to make a call, he says, and he walks out of the room. I take this as a victory, too. Detective Leong sits on the edge of the table. Her badge is at her hip. It's shiny, like a new toy. You must be so tired, she says, and I can hear in her voice the same game I was trying to play with the young cop in the holding cell. Nurses get used to working on very little sleep, I say evenly. And you've been a nurse for a while, right? 20 years. She laughs. God, I've been on the job for 9 months. I can't imagine doing anything for that long. I guess it's not work if you love it, right? I nod, still wary. But if I have a chance of making these detectives understand that I'm being railroaded, it's going to be with her. That's true. And I love what I do. You must have felt awful when you were told by your supervisor you couldn't take care of that baby anymore, she says. Especially given your level of expertise. It wasn't the best day I've ever had, no. My first day on the job, I totaled a police car. Drove it into a highway barrier at a construction site. Seriously, I scored highest on the detective exam, but in the field, I was a joke. The other guys in my class still call me Crash. I mean, let's be honest, a female detective has to work twice as hard as the guys, but the only thing they remember from me is a simple mistake. I was so upset. I still am. I look at her, the truth balanced on my tongue like a hard candy. I wasn't supposed to touch the baby, but I did, even though I could have gotten in trouble, and it still wasn't enough. Look, Ruth, the detective adds, if this was an accident, now would be the time to say so. Maybe the hurt you were feeling got the best of you. It would be totally understandable, given the circumstances. Just tell me, and I'll do what I can to make this go down easier. That is when I realize that she still thinks I'm at fault. That she's not being nice to me by sharing her own story. She's being manipulative. That those TV shows are right. I swallow hard, so that honesty sits in the pit of my belly. Instead, I speak 4 short words in a voice I do not recognize. I want a lawyer, I say.
Stage 1. Transition. The piano keys are black and white, but they sound like a million colors in your mind. Maria Cristina Mena. Kennedy. When I arrive at the office, Edgar Rockus, one of my colleagues, is spouting off about the new hire. One of our junior public defenders left to have a baby and informed HR that she wasn't returning. I knew that Harry, our boss, had been interviewing. But it isn't until Ed corners me at my cubicle that I realize a decision's been made.
Did you meet him yet?
Ed asks. Meet who?
Howard, the newbie.
Ed is the kind of guy who went into public defense because he could. In other words, he has a trust fund so large it doesn't matter how shitty our salaries are. And yet, in spite of the fact that he's grown up with every privilege possible, nothing is ever quite good enough. The Starbucks across the street serves coffee that's too hot. There was an accident on I-95N that made him 20 minutes late. The vending machine at the courthouse stopped carrying Skittles. I literally walked in here 4 seconds ago. How could I have a chance to meet anyone?
Well, he's clearly here to meet a diversity target. Just look for the puddles on the floor. This guy is so wet behind the ears, he's leaving a trail.
First, that metaphor didn't work.
No one drips from their ears. Second, so what if he's young? I realize that it's hard for someone of your advanced age to remember, but you were young once too. There were, Ed says, lowering his voice, more deserving candidates. I rummage through the piles on my desk for the files I need. There is a stack of pink phone messages waiting for me that I patently ignore. Sorry to hear your nephew wasn't picked, I murmur.
Very funny, Macquarie.
Look, Ed, I've got a job to do. I don't have time for office gossip. I lean toward my screen and pretend to be incredibly absorbed by my first email, which happens to be a solicitation from Nordstrom Rack. Eventually, Ed realizes I'm not going to engage with him anymore, and he stomps into the break room, where, no doubt, the coffee will not be up to par and we will be out of his favorite flavor of creamer. I close my eyes and lean back in my chair. Suddenly, I hear a rustle on the other side of my cubicle and a tall, slim, young black man stands up. He is wearing a cheap suit with a bow tie and hipster glasses. He is very clearly the new hire for this office, and he has been sitting there all along listening to Ed's comments.
Hashtag awkward, he says. I'm Howard, in case there's any doubt in your mind.
I stretch my face so far into a smile that I imagine the puppets Violet watches on Sesame Street, whose jaws can drop on a hinge when they are overcome by emotion. Howard, I repeat, jumping to my feet and immediately offering my hand to shake. I'm Kennedy. It's really nice to meet you.
Kennedy, he says. Like John F.
I get asked that all the time. Or Robert, I say. Although Howard was actually right. I might prefer to be named for the politician who did so much for civil rights, but in reality, my mother just had a crush on his ill-fated brother and the Camelot mythology. I will do whatever it takes to make this poor kid realize that at least one person in this office is glad he's here. So, welcome, I say brightly. If you need anything, have any questions about the way we do things here, feel free to ask me.
Great, thanks.
And maybe we can grab lunch? Howard nods.
I'd like that.
Well, I have to get to court. I hesitate and then address the elephant in the room. Also, don't listen to Ed. Not everyone around here thinks the way he does. I smile at him. For example, I think it's pretty amazing that you're giving back to your community. Howard smiles back at me.
Thanks, but I grew up in Darien.
Darien? One of the wealthiest towns in the state. Then he sits down, invisible behind the partition that's between us. I haven't even had my second cup of coffee yet, and I've already hustled through far too much traffic and a tangle of reporters, leaving me to wonder what is going on in Superior Court in the courtroom where I'm not. Since the only reason a TV crew might cover arraignments is to provide a sleep aid for insomniacs. So far, we have gotten through three cases. A criminal violation of a restraining order with a defendant who did not speak English. A repeat offender with bleached hair and bags under her eyes who allegedly issued a bad check for $1,200 to buy a designer purse. And a man who was dumb enough to not just steal someone's identity and start using the credit cards and bank account, but actually pick someone named Kathy and not think he was going to be caught. Then again, as I often tell myself, if my clients were all smarter, my job would be obsolete. The way it works in New Haven Superior Court on arraignment day is that one of us from the PD's office stands in for anyone who is brought before a judge and doesn't have a lawyer but needs one. It's like being trapped in a rotating door. And every time you step into the building, there's a whole new decor and layout, and you're expected to know where you're headed and how to navigate there. Most of the time, I meet my clients at the defense table, at which point I have the span of a heartbeat to assimilate the facts of their arrest and try to get them out on bail. Did I mention I hate arraignment day? It basically requires me to be Perry Mason with ESP, and even if I do a stellar job and manage to get personal reconnaissance bail for a defendant who otherwise would be locked up pending trial, chances are pretty good that I will not be the attorney litigating his case.
the juicy ones that I'd want to take to trial, will either be plucked out of my grasp by someone with more seniority at the office, or transfer to a private, read, paid lawyer. This is surely going to be the trajectory for the next defendant.
Next, the state versus Joseph Dawes Hawkins III,
the clerk reads. Joseph Dawes Hawkins is still so young that he has acne. He looks absolutely terrified, which is what a night in jail will do to you when your experience with criminal behavior is limited to binge-watching The Wire.
Mr. Hawkins,
the judge asks,
will you please identify yourself for the record? Joe Hawkins,
the boy replies. His voice cracks.
Where do you live? 139 Grand Street, Westville.
The clerk reads the charge. Drug trafficking. I'm going to guess, based on the kid's expensive haircut and his wide-eyed response to the legal system, he was pushing something like oxy, not meth or heroin. The judge enters an automatic plea of not guilty.
Joe, you've been charged with drug trafficking. Do you understand what that charge means?
The boy nods.
Do you have counsel present today?
He glances over his shoulder at the gallery, goes a little paler, and then says,
No. Would you like to speak to the public defender? Yeah, Your Honor,
he says, and that's my cue. Privacy is limited to the so-called cone of silence at the defense table. I'm Kennedy McQuarrie, I say. How old are you?
18. I'm a senior at Hopkins.
The private school. Of course he is. How long have you lived in Connecticut?
Since I was 2.
Is that a question or an answer? I ask.
Answer,
he says, and he swallows. His Adam's apple is the size of a monkey's fist knot, which makes me think of sailing, which makes me think of Violet swearing. Are you working? He hesitates.
You mean besides selling the oxy?
I didn't hear that, I reply immediately.
Oh, I said...
I didn't hear that. He glances up, nods.
Got it. No, I don't work.
Who do you live with?
My parents.
I am ticking off a checklist in my mind, peppering him with a barrage of questions. Do your parents have the means to hire an attorney? I ask finally. He glances at my suit, which is from Target, and which has a stain on it from the milk that Violet upended in her cereal bowl this morning.
Yeah?
Shut up and let me do the talking. I coach, and I turn to the bench. Your Honor, I say. Young Joseph here is only just 18, and this is his first offense. He's a senior in high school who lives with his mom and dad, a nursery school teacher, and a bank president. His parents own their own home. We ask for Joseph to be released on his own recognizance. The judge turns to my counterpart in this dance, the prosecutor who stands at the mirror image of the defense table. Her name is Odette Lawton, and she is about as jolly as the death penalty. Where most prosecutors and public defenders recognize that we are flip sides of the same shitty state pay grade coin and can leave the animosity in the courtroom and socialize outside it, Odette keeps to herself.
What is the state looking for, counselor?
She glances up. Her hair is cropped close to her head, and her eyes are so dark you can't see the pupils. She looks like she is well rested and has just had a facial. Her makeup is flawless. I stare down at my hands. The cuticles are bitten, and either I have green finger paint underneath the nails, or I am rotting from the inside out. This is a serious charge, Odette says. Not only was a prescription narcotic found on Mr. Hawkins's person, but there was intent to sell. To turn him loose into the community would be a threat and a grievous mistake. The state requests that bail be set at $10,000 with surety.
Bail is set at $10,000.
The judge repeats, and Joseph Dawes Hawkins III is lugged out of the courtroom by a bailiff. Well, you can't win them all. The good news here is that Joseph's family can afford the bail.
even if it means he will have to forfeit Christmas in Barbados. The better news is that I will never see Joseph Dawes Hawkins III again. His father may have wanted to teach him a lesson by not having the family attorney present from the get-go, so Joey would have to sit in a cell overnight. But I'm sure it is only a matter of time before that same fancy lawyer calls my office and picks up Joey's case.
The state versus Ruth Jefferson, I hear.
I glance up as a woman is led into the courtroom in chains, still wearing her nightgown, a scarf wrapped around her head. Her eyes scan the gallery wildly, and for the first time I realize that it's more crowded than usual for Tuesday arraignments. Packed, even.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
The judge asks. Ruth Jefferson, she says.
Murderer!
A woman screams. There is a buzz in the crowd that swells into a roar. Just then Ruth flinches. I see her turn her face into her shoulder, and I realize that she is wiping off the saliva that someone has spit on her from over the gallery rail. The bailiffs are already hauling the guy off, a hulking brute I can see only from the rear. On his scalp is a tattooed swastika, twined with letters. The judge calls for order. Ruth Jefferson stands tall and keeps looking around for someone, or something, that she can't seem to find.
Ruth Jefferson, the clerk reads, you are charged with count one, murder, count two, negligent homicide.
I am so busy trying to figure out what the hell is going on here that I do not realize everyone is looking at me, and that this defendant has apparently told the judge that she needs a public defender. Odette stands up. This is a heinous criminal act involving a three-day-old infant, Your Honor. The defendant voiced her animosity and animus toward the parents of this child, and the state will show that she acted intentionally and deliberately with malice aforethought in reckless disregard of the newborn's safety. And then, in fact, at her hands, the baby suffered trauma that led to death.
This woman killed a newborn? I'm running through scenarios in my head. Is she a nanny? Is this a shaken baby case? A SIDS death?
This is crazy! Ruth Jefferson explodes. I elbow her gently. This is not the time.
Let me talk to the judge, she insists.
No, I tell her. Let me talk to the judge for you. I turn to the bench. Your Honor, may we have a moment? I lead her to the defense table, just a few steps from where we are standing. I'm Kennedy McQuarrie. We'll talk about the details of your case later, but right now I need to ask you some questions. How long have you lived here?
They put me in chains, she says, her voice dark and fierce. These people came to my house in the middle of the night and handcuffed me. They handcuffed my son.
I understand that you're upset, I explain. But we have about 10 seconds for me to get to know you, so I can help you through this arraignment.
You think you can get to know me in 10 seconds?
She says. I draw back. If this woman wants to sabotage her own arraignment, it's not my fault.
Ms. McQuarrie, the judge says. Sometime before I get my AARP card, please.
Yes, Your Honor, I say, turning to him. The state recognizes the insidious and unpalatable nature of this crime, Odette says. She is staring right at Ruth. The dichotomy between these two black women is arresting. The prosecutor's sleek suit and spike heels and crisp-tailored shirt, standing in counterpoint to Ruth's rumpled nightgown and headscarf. It feels like more than a snapshot. It feels like a statement, like a case study for a course I don't remember enrolling in.
Given the magnitude of the charges, the state requests that the defendant be held without bail.
I can feel all the air rush out of Ruth's lungs. Your Honor, I say, and then I stop. I have nothing to work with. I don't know what Ruth Jefferson does for a living. I don't know if she owns a house or if she moved to Connecticut yesterday. I don't know if she held a pillow over that baby's face until it stopped breathing, or if she is rightfully angry about a trumped-up charge.
Your Honor, I repeat,
The state has offered no proof for their specious claims. This is a very serious charge with virtually no evidence. In light of this, I'd ask the court to set reasonable bail in the amount of $25,000 surety.
It's the best I can do, given the lack of information she's provided.
My job is to get Ruth Jefferson through her arraignment as efficiently and as fairly as possible. I glance up at the clock. There are probably about 10 more clients after her. Suddenly, there is a tug on my sleeve.
You see that, boy?
Ruth murmurs, and she looks at the gallery. Her gaze locks on a young man in the rear of the courtroom, who gets to his feet as if he is being drawn upright by a magnet.
That's my son, Ruth says.
And then she turns to me.
Do you have kids?
I think of Violet. I think of what it would be like if the biggest problem in your life was not watching your child getting frustrated, but watching your child getting handcuffed.
Your Honor, I say, I'd like to retract what I just said.
I beg your pardon, Counselor.
Before we discuss bail, I would like an opportunity to speak with my client.
The judge frowns.
You just had one.
I would like an opportunity to speak with my client for more than 10 seconds, I amend.
He rubs his hand over his face.
Fine, he concedes. You can speak to your client at the recess, and we'll revisit this matter at second call.
The bailiffs grab Ruth's arms. I can tell she has no idea what's going on.
I'm coming, I manage to tell her.
And then she's dragged out of the courtroom, and before I know it, I'm speaking on behalf of a 20-year-old who calls himself the symbol hashtag.
Like Prince, but not, he tells me,
who has spray-painted graffiti of a giant penis on a highway bridge and cannot understand why it's criminal mischief and not art.
I have 10 more arraignments, and during all of them, I'm thinking about Ruth Jefferson.
Thank God for the stenographer's union contract, which mandates a 15-minute pee break, during which I find my way into the dank, dirty guts of the courthouse to the holding cell where they've taken my client. She looks up from the metal bunk where she's sitting, rubbing her wrists. She's no longer wearing the chains that she had in the courtroom, like any other defendant accused of murder would have. But it's almost as if she doesn't notice they're gone.
Where have you been?
She asks, her voice sharp.
Doing my job, I reply.
Ruth meets my eye.
That's all I was doing, too, she says. I'm a nurse.
I start to piece together the puzzle. Something must have gone south during Ruth's care of the infant, something that the prosecution believes was not an accident.
I need to get some information from you. If you don't want to be locked up pending trial, you and I need to work together.
For a long moment, Ruth is silent, and it surprises me. Most people in her situation would grab onto the lifeline offered by a public defender. This woman, however, feels like she's trying to determine if I'm going to measure up. It's a pretty disturbing feeling, I must admit. My clients don't tend to be judgmental. They're people who are used to being judged and found lacking. Finally, she nods.
Okay, I say, letting out a breath I did not realize I'd been holding. How old are you?
44.
Are you married?
No, Ruth says. My husband died in Afghanistan during his second deployment. An IED went off. It was 10 years ago.
Your son... Is he your only child? I ask.
Yes. Edison's in high school, she says. He's applying to college right now. Those animals came into my house and handcuffed a straight-A student.
We'll get to that in a second, I promise. You have a nursing degree?
I went to SUNY Plattsburgh and then to Yale Nursing School.
Are you employed?
I worked at Mercy West Haven Hospital for 20 years on the birthing pavilion. But yesterday, they took my job away from me.
I make a note on a legal pad. What source of income do you have now?
She shakes her head.
My husband's military death benefits, I suppose.
Do you own your own home?
A townhouse in East End.
That's the area where Micah and I live. It's an affluent white neighborhood. The black faces I see there are usually passing through in their cars. Violence is rare, and when a mugging or a carjacking does happen,